This is the Interfaith America podcast, and I'm Eboo Patel. Monica Guzman is a bridge builder, journalist, and author who lives for great conversations sparked by curious questions. She's senior fellow for public practice at Braver Angels, host of the podcast A Braver Way, and author of the New York Times recommended read, I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. A Mexican immigrant, Latina, and dual U.S.-Mexico citizen, she lives in Seattle with her husband and two kids and is the proud liberal daughter of conservative parents. I loved her book and was inspired about her idea of being able to disagree about politics without losing heart or breaking family bonds. I wanted to continue the conversation here. Monica Guzman, I am so happy to be with you. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling really good and really looking forward to, this time to chat.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I never thought of it that way. I love the book. It is the perfect time for this book. It was perfect when you wrote it, and it's perfect now because we are in election season. And we seem to be as divided as ever as a country. So your book, I Never Thought of It That Way, is basically a primer on bridging divides by leading with the spirit of inquiry. So let me ask you this first big question. Give us some advice. What frame of mind should we be in as we hurtle towards this November election? Trump, Biden.
Frame of mind. I love that you put it that way because it's an invitation to think about it in terms of our own posture toward not just what's going on around us, but what that causes inside of us. We know that people are afraid and tense and anxious. We know that the issues are high stakes. We know that some people live with the consequences of these debates more than others. We know all of that. So what frame of mind to take going into this election season? I would say there's a couple things. A curious and open mind and a humility. So curiosity and humility make a really cool pairing. And they seem so counterintuitive for the moment for so many people. What we are tempted to accept is that we already know everything we need to know about these debates and what they're really about. We already know everything we need to know about our own positions on things. And we already know everything we need to know about those people and why they're making those awful decisions, the us versus them divide. So it's that fixedness that has really broken a lot of the dialogue and malleability and discovery that allows things like persuasion to happen in a democratic republic, that allows ideas to flow and add and subtract and change minds. So because an election season is a time of exercising one of the most formal forms of civic power, the vote, right? This is the time, if there has been a time in the last 4 years, to elevate our ability to inform each other about what is really going on. Inside ourselves, the concerns that inform our perspectives, and try to understand the concerns that inform other people's perspectives so we can see past a lot of the projections that are in our mind, a lot of the certainty that's in there telling us what it's all about. We're so divided, we're blinded. So priority number one is see the debates and the people around you all the way.
Curiosity, humility. Do not imagine monsters where there might not be monsters, where there are actually just people. There's a line you use over and over again in the book. Remind me of this line, something along the lines of like, whatever is small in reality will play a bigger role in your imagination. What's the exact line?
It's whoever is underrepresented in your life will be overrepresented in your imagination.
Yeah.
And that's always true to an extent, but the consequences of that have never been higher than right now. There's so much evidence showing that we are misperceiving people who are different from us. And if there's a lot of fear and anxiety, that just amplifies the level to which we feel we already know we need to know. And so we lock ourselves in this place of like, I'm relying on what I imagine you to be. I imagine you to be a monster.
Right. I mean, I think to myself, like how useful that is in my personal life. So I remember being shocked at the statistic that more than 60% of Americans do not have a four-year college degree. Of the 500 or 1,000 people I interact with in my life on a regular basis, there may be less than five people that I know that don't have a four-year college degree. Factor into that, that of America's 2,600 colleges, probably 10%, maybe 20% are selective. And in my life, probably 95% of the people I interact with went to a selective university. So all of a sudden, I'm realizing my world is the top 10% of the upper 35% of America's socioeconomic ladder. To live in a diverse democracy means to be curious and humble about people you don't know so much about.
Exactly. And it takes humility even to understand that what you see is not all there is.
Yeah.
And that's what you've done just in that one illustration. I'm in a similar boat, you know, where I saw that same statistic about college degrees. And I thought my whole world is folks who have a pretty uniform experience on this one thing. And then the curiosity comes in and it can turn into self-inquiry. What am I missing?
Totally. Right.
About the economic reality that influences Americans, because I am not interacting with people in a different part of that spectrum as much as I am with people in the same place that I am.
Right.
And so that kind of humility and curiosity paired up, I mean, yeah, that's what's going to serve us really, really well if
that's
we can
the
exercise
frame of mind. Right. And it wouldn't one want to learn more about the world? I mean, curiosity is such a wonderful trait because it's enlightened self-interest. You learn more when you're curious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always tell my kids, I'm telling them because I'm really telling myself, I say mode of inquiry, not mode of judgment, right? You can imagine how that lands on the ears of two teenage boys. But you know, like, why wouldn't you go into the world looking to learn more rather than judge more, right?
Right, right. And we know the reasons, right? Our gut can come up with reasons because it stinks to be wrong. I don't want to be wrong. I don't want to be excluded. I don't want to put at risk my sense of belonging. I mean, we all know where the resistance comes from. We can be honest about that.
One of the things that you write about is the harms of blind judgment. And I think to myself, boy, is it such a joy to judge people. It's right. Like the feeling of self-righteousness, the dopamine hit. Like I literally listen to my sons do it in the living room all the time, judging people about what they're wearing and about their Instagram picture. And like, I'm like listening to the joy in their voices. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I am a teenage boy an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Like in my mind, like I'm judging people. And here's the thing, in your book, you don't do it. You don't judge other people. Why are you letting yourself not experience all the joy of judgment? There's so much joy out there in judging people in a more serious way. Tell us about the discipline about not judging. Is there a discipline involved?
Is there a discipline involved? I hesitate to answer. My gut says yes. I think the reason I hesitate to answer is because once you say that something is a discipline, people hear that they can't do it unless they focus on it really, really hard, and it's probably impossible. I'm fascinated by your question. I've never heard it put quite that way. Why didn't I experience the joy of judging in this book that I wrote? And I hope you'll indulge me in kind of reflecting out loud because I've never thought about this question this way.
Please. That's the best part about podcasts.
Yeah, that's what they're for, right? I was really afraid that I would write this book from this deep desire inside me to help, and that by virtue of having judgments in there against people who are not like me that I did not see, I would undermine my own goal. I was terrified that I would do that. And because I've been in media my whole career, it's become clear to me through my experience that oftentimes the most alienating and awful judgments are the subtle ones. So for example, in my book, I took, and I'll just say this bluntly, great pains to balance my examples. So that if I sort of assumed that my reader, you know, I invited my reader to imagine something from the blue perspective.
Yeah.
I had to also invite my reader to imagine something from the red perspective. I didn't let myself think, oh, my readers are probably blue because this is me. And by blue, I mean liberal leaning. This is me and who I am and how I see the world. And I think most of it is right. And so that way I'm just going to stand in that perspective and just assume that my readers are there, or I'm not even going to notice that I'm carving a difference as the status quo. And so I kept thinking to myself, like, my parents who are conservative, you know, would they be able to read this book? Is there any page that would make them think, ugh, you know, that would make them feel slighted? And I was working really hard to make sure that that didn't happen. Now, I can't say that I succeeded. I don't know. I'm not the judge of that.
Yeah.
But it felt really important. If I want to reach people across the political divide, I can't judge them. I can't.
Look, I think you just offered a very useful discipline or mental exercise, which is take somebody you care about who holds a different perspective and imagine their eyes reading what you've written or hearing what you've said. And how would they feel? And I imagine you are very sensitive to other people condescending to your parents. So why would you want to do that?
Exactly. And look, like, I've had so many conversations, not just with them. I mean, before the book, it was largely with them and a handful of others. But now, in the work that I've done, so many folks who come at the world from, you know, some universe of what we label the more conservative frame, that I see subtle judgments everywhere now. Ibu, they are everywhere.
Totally.
And we wonder why we're not able to talk to each other. But we don't even see that the waters we're swimming in, a lot of us, are waters that we have created to be intimately familiar to us, but that we have not created with people who are different from us in mind. And we don't even notice. We don't even notice that the whole universe that we've built in some of these spaces is, like, not only alien, but kind of cringy to folks who are different. This is one of the costs of a society that has grown this siloed and divided, is it starts to become blind to its own judgments. We think we're being super open. We don't even realize, we don't even see everywhere the judgments hide.
I mean, let me just tell you a quick story that illustrates that. Some years back, I'm like reading aloud some Atlantic article. I'm reading it at the table, and I read the section aloud where 70% of people in a county that has a Whole Foods vote for Democrats, 70% of people in a county that has a Cracker Barrel vote for Republicans. And it struck me that those two institutions are almost never in the same county, right? So I'm kind of reading this aloud. And I say to my wife, I'm like, my wife and my kids, I'm like, huh, what, you know, that's interesting. What do you make of that? And one of my kids says, what's Cracker Barrel?
Yeah.
Right. And you think to yourself, like, the restaurant that serves as a symbol for an entire swath of the country, my kids have never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I've never even heard of what you think is important, you know?
Right. Oh, wow. That sort of struck me, the way you put it.
I've never even
heard of what you think is important.
And
that's how disconnected we are.
And by the way, that makes me feel more self-righteous.
Oh, say more.
What I mean by that is, like, the way I describe some of the fancy places where you and I go and speak, like the Aspen Institute, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, we get excited because we know that the people who go there know that they're important. And therefore, the people that they're around must be important too. Right.
It's so, prestige by association.
That's right. But basically, it's like, I know I'm important. So if you are in the same, if you are in proximity to me, you're probably important too.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically the value game that we are playing.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
We're actually super aware of it. We are super aware of it. Right. But I don't want to kid myself about what I'm actually doing.
And how would you describe what you are actually doing?
I mean, it is when you brag about going to a selective university, you are saying, I'm proud of going to a place that rejected 95% of its applicants.
The exclusivity.
Yeah.
Because it's exclusive, I feel really elevated. I feel really good. I feel good.
I am basically saying, I'm proud that 99% of you couldn't get it.
Right, right. And it's exclusivity combined with proximity to power, because there's signals that that it's exclusion, but those who get in, I mean, look at the data, look at what they're able to do. It's circles of importance meeting circles of importance meeting circles of importance.
Right. And we kind of lather each other up. I spend a lot of my time at elite universities, and I think they're very important institutions. I don't want to be dismissive of them, right? Okay. And if I was the president of an elite university, the way that I would begin my convocation address to incoming first-year students is, you're amongst the most privileged people in human history. I am not scolding you. I'm just telling you an objective fact.
Yeah.
Right?
And don't forget it.
Yeah. And what does that mean? Okay. I would rather embrace my privilege than pretend I don't have it. I would rather embrace it and ask the question, what is the responsibility that corresponds with this? And a huge part of that is curiosity and humility. That's the very least you can do if you run in the circles we run in.
Yeah.
Be curious and humble.
I completely agree, because it's at those, for many reasons, but primarily because it's at those levels of high influence and power, first, where people see certainty as a strength and power becomes synonymous with a confidence that may not have any room for curiosity. But even the data shows us that that doesn't even hold up. Not really, not in practice, not when you test it. But also when folks who are, you know, leaders or seen as leaders or influencers in any way, when they model incuriosity, because let's be honest, the negative state of this is a thing. When they model incuriosity, every space that they influence, it can trickle down. It can adopt that tone. It can feel like, I can't say anything, blah, blah, blah. You know, nobody's, we have to give each other cover, right? We have to give people practices, conventions, precedents that they can point to and take shelter under, you know, because that person that we all respect here has done that. I can do that. I know I can do that. And I should be safe.
Well, I think that that's a huge part of what your book does. And I don't want to use, I feel like giving cover is an inadequate description of the power of this book, right? Mm-hmm. It is shining the light on an alternative path, and frankly, a path that we have all, be curious and humble. This is not rocket science, right? This is kind of familiar, walk a mile in somebody else's shoes type of stuff that for some reason in the last 6, 8, 10 years, there has been a self-righteousness associated with incuriosity. Right. Yes. But I think the tide is turning. And actually, one of the ways I know it's turning is the number of institutions that have chosen your book as a common book read. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm hearing about it everywhere. So one of the places is Vanderbilt University. I hope it becomes a standard text at that university and at other universities, you know, from universities that admit people who don't take the ACT to universities where you basically have a perfect ACT score to get admitted. I hope that universities think of pluralism and curiosity and humility and civil dialogue and learning is at the heart of an education, not inculcation into an ideology and the application of that ideology as far as possible. So what should we expect those students to be able to do for our democracy on the other side of reading your book? And let me give you an analogy. If you graduate from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical School and I hire you, I expect you to be able to fly a plane. You graduate from flight school, you should be able to be a pilot. If you graduate from a school of civil dialogue where Monica Guzman is the person you are reading, what should you be able to do in our polarized environment? What can we expect of you? That's the equivalent of flying a plane.
Mm-hmm. You can hear and be heard.
I love it.
You can hear and be heard. And by that, I mean, you can hear it all. And you can speak in a way that the power of your story and experience can be present and absorbed and shared. That takes a certain confrontation with certainty and our assumptions about certainty and leadership and all these things. It takes a confrontation with fear. It takes an inner awareness of the role you play in these things. It takes getting past the common refrain that the world is broken and it's their fault and therefore their responsibility. So hear and be heard. We cannot have an effective democratic republic if enough people don't know how to do that. But going back to something you were saying earlier about, you know, this being a skill and we've got to learn it, and there's so much to learn. I think one of the things that kind of bugs me ultimately when people talk about how hard this is again, it makes it sound like, oh my gosh, you've got to get degrees in it. You know, you've got to study in this textbooks, and boy, it's a high level thing. But I think it's actually more true to say that it's not about teaching something. It's about remembering something. It's not about learning something. It's about what you unlearn. Because like you said, this is not actually rocket science. You know, there are people selling books about it. True. But it's not rocket science. What it is I don't know. This is a hard thing to articulate, but I hope you're following me a little bit on this thread that I'm trying to get to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The stuff this is about, we have been talking about and feeling and intuiting and building rituals around for thousands of years. There are religious traditions, spiritual traditions. There are psychological and philosophical traditions that have intuited how people work for many, many, many years. Right now, because we live in a somewhat more technocratic age and because it's the height of education and academia, we want to nail everything down with science, which is awesome. And so we're doing that. You know, there's like incredible research going on intellectual humility. And I literally earlier today told someone about a study that I heard about from intellectual humility and its finding. And the response from this person was, yeah, but isn't that obvious? And I was like, yeah, it is. The finding was that we now know from research that awe, the emotion of awe, once you feel it, and of wonder, makes you more intellectually humble. That once you feel that emotion, you're more intellectually humble. And so this person was like, yeah, but duh.
Right. I mean, this is like, honestly, this is kind of kindergarten level stuff. Like, share. Like, right. Think of how somebody else feels. Some of this is, right? What I mean is, like, mm-hmm. It is what many parents teach many kids, and every kindergarten teacher teaches, which is, how do you think the other person feels?
Right.
Right. And right. And the other person is not exactly like you. That, by the way, that's diversity, right?
Right.
More to come with Monica Guzman after the break.
By the way, if you're enjoying this conversation, you ought to check out my new book, We Need to Build: Field Notes for Diverse Democracy. It's a guide for those who want to make positive social change and an invitation into the next chapter of American religion, a chapter I'm calling Interfaith America. We Need to Build is published by Beacon Press and available wherever you buy books. Now, back to the podcast.
As you were saying, there's all these traditions around this. So when I was at Oxford, speaking of elite universities, I used to go to a Quaker meeting on Sundays occasionally.
Yeah.
So a Quaker meeting is, you are silent for an hour unless you feel moved by God to speak.
Yes.
Okay. So if you want to be the guy who like stands up every 5 minutes, you are saying an awful lot about how much God talks to you, right? So it's basically like, this is a discipline of silence unless you feel like cosmic lightning is striking you. That is a ritual of sit with your thoughts in a group of other people.
That's right. Right. That's right. And it's funny you bring up the Quaker meeting. I'm at a nonprofit called Braver Angels, which is all about the political divide, as you know. And a woman named Laura is over in Braver Angels Europe. So we have chapters of Braver Angels in Europe. And she is a Quaker. And so she sent me in the mail a little pamphlet about Quaker practices, but for like secular audiences. But it was made from, you know, inside the Quaker institution, basically, it was such as there is one, there kind of isn't one. And I read that short pamphlet with my jaw open. Just wait a minute. You mean, because I didn't know,
right,
that there is a religious tradition going back a long time in America that like figured a lot of this stuff out about listening and about giving people space and about all of that and how important it is and how it bonds community and how it brings out real concerns. I mean, what Quakers will do when there is dissent is fascinating, you know? And again, it's like, you know, going back to how many of us have college degrees, there's sort of this sense of, you know, everything there really is to know is in the is in these institutions that have been granted this enormous credibility for really nailing down knowledge about the knowledge that we need to be around. But man, look at some other places, because there's a deep wisdom that's been there.
Totally. And actually, that should make us happy, right? Like when you think to yourself, actually, I'm not discovering something. I am a part of a tradition of hearing and being heard. How much, you know, when I was younger, I really wanted to be the person to discover things. As I got older, I was like, I want to be part of an ongoing community of people, a community across generations that is trying to move the world a millionth of an inch. You know, as Gary Snyder might say, like, that's what gives me comfort. I don't want to be the Lone Ranger. I want to be part of a community of people. And speaking of that, your book is in a community of books. And some of the books I'm talking about are behind you, right? Amanda Ripley's High Conflict, Ben Sasse's Them. I'm going to be doing a podcast with David Brooks pretty soon on his new book, How to Know Someone. What do you make of the fact that there's this whole spate of books that have come out in the last 10 years or so? Peter Coleman's The Way Out. There's probably 12, 15, 20 such books, maybe more. Irshad Manji's Don't Label Me, that are basically about the dangers of what you call SOS, the dangers of sorting, othering, and siloing from your book, the importance of conversations that build connections, the underpinnings of which are curiosity and humility. What do you make of this kind of new chapter in an age-old literature of this kind of work?
Yeah. And you know what I think it is? Like we were saying, right? There's nothing new under the sun in some ways. There's a lot of traditions that have been talking about some of these ideas in different ways. But what I think is true about society is that, much like you can't see one love story and then that's it, I don't want to see any more love stories, I get it. You know, and Hollywood keeps giving us the same basic story in different shapes and forms over and over and over again. The basic wise ideas of what it means to be human have to be reinterpreted for every era.
Yeah.
For every era's specific needs and specific concerns and specific anxieties. We all get into our own heads. And a lot of us get into our own heads together. We have formed communities in this era. Boy, communication has accelerated that process because of technology, et cetera. So highly recommend this book, How Minds Change by David McRaney. I just interviewed him for my podcast yesterday. And the reason I bring him up is because his book is also getting selected for a lot of college reading programs. And so we got together and chatted about it. And he used a phrase that I thought was like spot on as a response to your question, which is that we want to return to the fundamentals. We need a return to the fundamentals. I think that the last 20 years or so, we have spun up and up and up, and we have gotten so far away from each other that it has also felt like we've been sort of pulled away from the fundamentals of disagreeing with, like, which like is necessary from, you know, when you're a little kid, like you start practicing it when you're very young, and like the fundamentals of thinking, how do we think well? What does that even mean? The fundamentals of relationship,
right?
Because clearly it's really important. You know, we see things like the loneliness epidemic. We see things like huge consciousness about mental health. We are so concerned about young people right now because we see some really disturbing statistics. We are really concerned about our institutions. Have they lost their way? Is the trust they have lost, is that because it's been unearned, or is there something else going on? We're asking really deep, painful questions, even about the stability of our very societies. And those kinds of questions make us freak out, which we've been doing. But I think it also, at some point after a freak out, right? What do? When you're kind of calmer, you go, let's start at the beginning.
I love that. Right. That honestly sounds like life in a family. Like, you know, you have a freak out and you're like, okay, first thing you do is that you apologize, right? Like,
well, yeah, some repair is probably in order.
But then you're like, how did we get here? I love that. Monica, let me ask you a question. Why is the symbol of our era the raised fist and not the open hand?
Whoa.
Let me connect this to something historical. So Kwame Anthony Appiah, the prominent social philosopher of pluralism who writes the Ethicist column in the New York Times magazine every week, he's got this op-ed in the New York Times from a few years ago, tells the story of this like frumpy British parliamentarian, this guy in the British Parliament, like in the 1950s, married straight, got a couple kids, just decides it's wrong for Britain to have laws that criminalize gay relationships, gay intimacy. And so he moves a bill through Parliament that gets passed. And Appiah is like, how come nobody's ever heard of this guy? I mean, clearly very effective, right? How come everybody's heard of Stonewall, but nobody's heard of the guy who passes the bill in the Parliament in Britain years before, right? What is it in human beings that is attracted to the raised fist and not the extended palm? Why do we want social change by revolution and not by agreement and negotiation?
Because we give a lot more value to the fighter than the communicator. I think that's my first answer. We give more value to that character in our fiction. And by we, I mean America, you know. And maybe, I guess the deeper question would be, well, is that an American thing or is that a human thing? Like, maybe that's just in our biology. We root for the hero who's fighting, you know, his or her way or their way to some victory. But without a setback, it's boring. It's just not that sexy. It's not that interesting. We don't experience the full range of emotions. And there is something about story. And when we experience the full range of emotions, James Cameron, the director of Titanic and the Avatar movies, once said that movies are really about testing the pipes. That we love movies because we want to test our emotions. We're okay with movies making us horribly, horribly sad and scared and all of that because we know we're going to get the resolution at the end, at least most of the time. We're going to then, because we were so sad, you know, in Dune, which I just saw Dune 2, you know, we were so sad that, you know, well, I shouldn't spoil the story, but something horrible happens to the hero. Yeah. We then, because we were that sad, we get that happy to see the conclusion. That look at what they were able to do. Look how destined for greatness. Look at all the risks they took. Look at all the victories that they won. Look at what they were able to do for their community. It's like, there's just this high octane. But with the communicator, well, gee, you know, I don't feel the full range of human emotions the way that story is typically told. And so I think we just spread those stories and some of them get us going and some of them don't.
So
maybe that's it.
So I think that this is, I mean, for those of us who communicate for a living, you and me, right? Like our job is to tell, you know, as my friend Simon Greer says, the hero is the bridge builder. The hero is the bridge builder, right? And I'm not going to ask your age, but I'll tell you mine. I'm 48. I kind of come of age in the 90s. And you know who the hero is in the 90s? Mandela. And you know what was heroic about him? What was heroic about him was Mandela with the outstretched hand to white people in the time of apartheid. Yeah. And the movie that's made is Invictus, where Mandela embraces the sport that's associated with the white Afrikaners in South Africa, and that's rugby. And he changes the symbol from this is a white Afrikaner sport to this is a South African sport. That this is the symbol for the Rainbow Nation, right? And, you know, Mandela learns the names of his jailer's kids. He learns their language, right? And and right now we're living in a Frantz Fanon moment, right? The you become human and free by the violence through which you destroy your enemy.
That's right? It. That's it. And I will say that what this is making me realize is we embrace a fiction. You know, I just watched Lord of the Rings, all three movies with my kids, which was really fun.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It was a lot of hours. But I was reminded of how the Lord of the Rings fantasy is as much to do with the fantasy of moral clarity. You know, that there's like clear good guys and clear bad guys. It's as much to do with that as with the fact that there are orcs and wizards and magic or whatever. We are embracing the fantasy because it is one that the fight for good and evil is the way to make good in the world. That's not even really that true. Like if you go through, and you know this better than I do, so maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but you go through so many of the social movements. And even though a lot of the stories that get the attention, you know, are the ones that really select down to the revolutionary aspects. If that change was sustainable, it was probably much more than that, probably much deeper than that. And you're only looking at a little tip of the iceberg over here that got a lot of attention.
And the funny thing is, like, you think to yourself, like, why do you want that? Right? Like, Robespierre doesn't become Mandela. Robespierre becomes the Ayatollah. right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want a scorched earth approach to social change, because right. what do you think the new social order is going to look like?
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you smash your way to social change, arsonists don't build new cities. Architects yeah. build new cities, right? Yeah. I mean, one of the lines in my book, We Need to Build, is you defeat the things you do not love by building the things you do, right? So yeah. shake your fist at the food desert all you want. But my friends in the southwest side of Chicago at the Inner City Muslim Action Network, you know what they did? They built a grocery store.
Yeah.
And now it's not a food desert anymore.
Right.
Right?
That's like, how literally. You solve the actual problem.
Exactly.
Like, but when it comes to, you know, your emotional, that maybe some of the dopamine, maybe some of the sense of the of belonging that you want with people who registrously agree with you, it goes back to what you said earlier. It feels really good to judge people. Why does it feel really good to judge people? Oftentimes it's because it's what cements your belonging.
Right.
Because
right. this is a
right?
belonging
you're
thing,
judging
not a rationality
them,
thing.
Which
right.
makes the us more defined.
Yeah. yeah.
And
yeah.
makes you feel more secure in the us. If you can judge the them and people around you go, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're like, yeah, we know who we are because we know who we're not.
That's right. And this is like, there's a term for this, affective polarization, which basically right. is fancy graduate school language for, I don't really know who I am, but I know I hate you. Right.
Exactly.
So here's the problem. There's many problems. One of the problems is we are not only hating the far away neighbor, we are hating the near to us neighbor. School boards are falling apart. City councils are falling apart. Libraries are falling apart. High school theaters are falling apart. Like literally
yeah.
every day you read another story. Library in Lake Luzerne, New York is permanently closed because there was a knockdown drag out fight over drag queen story hour. And it was so traumatic. The librarians not only quit, but had to be hospitalized and nobody reapplied for their jobs. The library is closed.
And here's the thing.
Front page
here's
New York Times.
Yeah. It's okay. That thing about whoever's underrepresented in your life will be overrepresented in your imagination. Super salient to this point. I think that the people who showed up to that, I suspect, and I don't know, that the people who showed up to that fight about a drag queen story hour already came knowing, thinking they knew what they were going to find when the people on the other side opened their mouths. So that no matter what the people on the other side would have said, we don't even really listen because we've been seeing the national headlines. We know that this is a big thing over there. And we have absorbed the most shocking stories. We've absorbed the people on the other side who have behaved the worst.
Right.
And
right.
we're afraid of them. And we see them in our neighbor instantly. Because if you are on the same side as that thing that I saw on MSNBC, on Fox News, and whatever, then I think I know you and I think I know what I'm going to get, which means everybody comes in super tense, temperature really high, and they're looking just for a little bit of evidence to affirm
right.
that judgment is correct. And they're going to find it because they've already decided that the real evidence is not found by listening openly to the individuals who have come together in the community. No. The evidence is in their language. The evidence is in their posture. The evidence is in, did you see the look that
right,
person had?
Right.
I bet it's a look of malevolence. They see it in those things rather than coming in and asking and sitting and listening and making sure that the people on the other side feel relaxed and calm enough and are not guarded. But everybody comes in guarded. And guardedness and fearfulness is the source of a lot of behaviors that can read like malevolence. So
right.
it's like, we don't even, you know, we're just not freaking listening. And so what, so it's broken before we've even come in, before we've even entered the room, it's broken in our minds. And it's mostly about what's going on in our minds, not what's going on in the headlines.
Right. I want to enter rooms looking for reasons to like people. Like I'm looking yeah. for a reason to like the people I disagree with.
Yeah.
Right. It's funny. You know, we all give ourselves points in our mind, right? Like, oh, I did a really good job at that. I want to create a category in my mind. Did I make a positive connection with someone with whom I disagree with today? Did I make yeah. a positive connection with somebody from a different world today? Did I find something to talk to them about? I think you do a really good job of this in your book. You're basically like, conversation is about making connection. Can you have a conversation in a way that makes a positive connection with someone? Like, try it out.
Yeah.
It's a skill.
Yeah.
It's a thing. So
mm-hmm.
So you, in the book, you play this game, the I never thought of it that way game, right? Mm. So I want you to give me one of yours and I'm going to give you one of mine as we close. Like, what's one of your most recent I never thought of it that way moments? And I'll tell you one of mine and we'll close with that.
I really like this. Okay, you go first because I have to think of one.
So during the rollout of the vaccine, I was a big proponent of people getting the vaccine. I was very forgiving to African-Americans who were leery about the vaccine because of Tuskegee. It's the, right, all of these like medical experiments done in African-Americans that were about how the medical establishment misrepresented itself to Black communities over history, which has created this historical memory and probably, you know, current good reasons also about why you should be wary of what medical authorities are telling you. And then I watch Dope Sick on Hulu, which is about how pharmaceutical companies peddled OxyContin in places like Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And as I'm watching this, a big part of the story is about how the FDA put approval labels on OxyContin. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, if I'm like a coal miner in West Virginia and I'm like, well, the government thinks it's okay and I get addicted to something, why would I ever trust the government about medicine again? And it turns out that it's really bad for you. Right? And it occurred to me, like, honestly, Monica, not a single person in my heavily graduate school educated world has ever said anything to me about that. Wow. Nobody has ever said, well, the government slapped approval labels on OxyContin, which killed lots of working class white folks. Maybe those folks who lean evangelical Christian have a justifiable reason to be leery of a government-supported intervention like the vaccine. Nobody ever said that to me.
Yeah. Like sometimes when something's landed with you, you kind of laugh at the shock of it. And I was hearing from someone who told me, tradition is peer pressure from dead people. I was like,
yeah, right.
Whoa, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
Peer pressure from what? You know, like the thing about I never thought of it that way moments is you don't know which ones are going to plant a seed in your mind. And I was looking through my list and there's several that I can't share because they would open up too big of a conversation and it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
To share them without more, right? But anyway, but yeah, some of them plant seeds in your mind that may get dug out of the ground tomorrow, or you may find in like a year, something has changed. And when you inquire why you've changed your mind on something, you remember that moment when you heard somebody say something in a particular way, or when you heard a story. So, man, if we became more aware of what was going on in our minds, what seeds are getting planted, what the soil is doing, what is happening with the ground, where it's fertile, where it isn't. If we look inward, then I think we'll just get more adept at controlling the only thing we can control in this world, which is ourselves.
Totally. It's a perfect place to leave it. Monica Guzman, you are awesome. I am grateful for your book. I'm even more grateful for your friendship. Thank you for being who you are, and go impact those students. Go impact those students.
Thank you, Ibu. This was wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate you. Friends, I loved that conversation with Monica, and I learned so much. I hope you did too. One of the things I learned was, how do you have a conversation which inspires a connection? How do you lead with inquiry and not judgment? Let's ask ourselves some questions. What have I never thought about? How am I leading with curiosity instead of animosity? I'd love to hear how it goes. Message us in the comments or wherever you live on social media. You can find us on Twitter at Interfaith USA and Instagram at Interfaith America. To read more about this conversation and to find resources and stories about bridge building in our religiously diverse nation, visit our website, interfaithamerica.org. I'm Ibu Patel.